Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, this is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today, February 16th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. So stay tuned for this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Thank you.
Of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis. Today, February 16th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. And, of course, this week in the Pan-African Journal, we're going to be listening in a few minutes to our regular Pan-African Newswire reports, and we have a lot to discuss this week in regard to the Pan-African Newswire dispatches that are published on a daily basis. And you can get more information about how you can log on to the Pan-African Newswire later in this program. So we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Oh, Lee Kuan Yen, Banda Let the whole world should be singing. Oh.
Of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe.
I'm
This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to the Pan-African Journal for this week. We just heard the sound of South African Lucky Dube, and of course he had the tune entitled War and Crime. Yes, Lucky Dube with the sound entitled War and Crime. And before that, we heard I've Got You, Babe, alive. Rendition of that track from Lucky Dube, and before that, Different Colors, also by Lucky Dube. Then, of course, we heard a medley of tunes by Franco and the TPOK Jazz Band, Komi Na Mbemba. We also heard Kweyi, as well as Ton Ton. So welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal for this week. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today, we're broadcasting live February 16th, 2013 from our studios here in the city of Detroit. And right now, we'd like to move into our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. And in this week's segment of the Pan-African Journal's Pan-African Newswire, we'd like to let you know the major stories we're going to be reviewing and analyzing for this week. First of all, right now, this weekend, the commemorations of the second anniversary of the counter-revolution in the North African state of Libya has been marked by demonstrations and heightening security inside of that oil-rich country. Several articles by apologists for imperialism, who in fact attempted some 2 years ago to justify the war of regime change against the Jemahiriya headed by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, have admitted publicly that the United States and NATO-led war that overthrew the Jemahiriya has been an unmitigated disaster for the country and its people. These failures, however, are now being utilized as a rationale for even deeper imperialist intervention in Libya. In the North African state of Egypt, organizations have called for an investigation into the death of the activist Mohamed El Gende. Meanwhile, demonstrations have continued across the country against the Freedom and Justice Party government of Mohamed Morsi. In the southern African state of Zimbabwe, the country is preparing for a national referendum on a new constitution. The vote, which is scheduled to take place on March the 16th, is a precursor for political elections that will take place later in the year. And finally, the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice, MECAWI, has issued a call for a conference on Africa and U.S. imperialism. The conference is being held in commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Organization of African Unity, the successor organization, the predecessor organization of the African Union. The OAU was founded in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia on May the 25th of 1963. And those are going to be the main stories that we'll be covering in this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And as we mentioned, this weekend commemorates the second anniversary of the beginning of the rebellion in the eastern region of Libya against the government of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. And over the last few days, a series of articles have been published by people, many of whom were proponents and apologists of imperialist intervention in Libya during 2011, who are admitting openly that the overthrow of the Gaddafi government, the massive bombing campaign by the United States and NATO, the seizure of over $160 billion in national assets in Libya, the capturing and torture and brutal assassination of Muammar Gaddafi has actually brought about a horrendous security situation inside of Libya. One article, which was published on February the 14th, and of course it is entitled "The Importance of Stabilizing Libya." Of course, it should be entitled "The Importance of Destabilizing Libya." It's written by Jacob Pack and Karim Mizran. The article says that from Cairo on the Nile to Tunis on the Mediterranean, a political vacuum has descended into North Africa. It says the, quote, Arab Spring, unquote, ushered in new freedoms, and we put those, the term freedoms in quotes, or brackets, but has also weakened existing state structures and unleashed a cultural and political free-for-all favorable to mobilization, assassination, and propagation of extremist ideology. This same article goes on to say that the region's newly elected, which it should say selected governments, are rapidly failing to produce results, put aside internecine bickering, or form grand coalitions, despite their, quote, democratic legitimacy, should be democratic illegitimacy. They are losing the consent of their populations. Amid this chaos, North Africa's Saharan underbelly, the Sahel, is on the verge of replacing the Afghanistan-Pakistan border as the major global safe haven for terrorist networks. Libya is both at the root of these problems and the key to the solution, this article says. It goes on to say that the spread of Salafist and jihadist groups, the war in Mali, and the recent terrorist attack in Algeria are all direct consequences of the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi. Paradoxically, international action and support of the Libyan people led to this whole mess, yet it is also the key to resolving it. At present, Libya's new central government, which is still a rebel regime, is so weak that swaths of the country are ungoverned space, local authorities mediate disputes, and the so-called revolutionary militia dominate what few security institutions exist. Radicalized jihadists come and go as they please, and heavy artillery from Gaddafi's stockpiles is sold to the highest bidder. And it's quite interesting that they're still blaming Gaddafi a year and a half after his death for the proliferation of weapons inside of Libya as well as throughout the region. Gaddafi is no longer on the scene. The Jemahiriya has been overthrown, although there are still many supporters of his government inside of Libya and throughout the region. But it is quite interesting how they're still attempting to blame the martyred leader, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, for the chaos that is going on right now in Libya and that has spread throughout West and North Africa. Now, until very recently, the post-Gaddafi Libyan government lacked the legitimacy, will, or power to demobilize the so-called revolutionary militias or secure the country's borders. Fortunately, in the wake of what they call successful elections, one man has emerged who is capable of rationalizing Libya's institutions and securing its future. And they claim this person is Prime Minister Ali Zidane, although nothing fundamentally has changed. In fact, it has worsened. Just recently, the rebel government in Libya called for NATO assistance in sealing the borders of the country right on the eve of the second anniversary of the counter-revolution. Politically, this article continues, Zidane has to contend with an ongoing power struggle against Mohamed Magariaf, the president of the Libyan parliament, the so-called General National Congress. The president was supposed to be a ceremonial position, yet Magariaf is deliberately exceeding his hazily defined authority to play Libya's deep social cleavages to his advantage. Now, on February the 6th, members of the GNC, this purported parliament, which in fact barred the elections in Libya, barred all supporters of the former government of Muammar Gaddafi from participating in the elections or even pronouncing a political program. In fact, they said that they would arrest and imprison anyone who had raised the advances of the previous government, the 42-year-old government of Muammar Gaddafi, which in fact turned Libya into an economic and political paradise. Libya, of course, attained through its oil and natural gas wealth and its mass distribution of these resources had attained the highest living standard on the African continent, as well as a higher living standard than many countries in Western as well as Eastern Europe. Now, as we said before, on February the 6th, members of the GNC announced that the Constitutional Committee will be directly elected by the Libyan people. Well, it sounds familiar. People may have read about or experienced the concept of direct democracy, the people's committees, the popular organizations of the people under the Jemahiriya. They say they want to return to a similar system now in Libya due to the chaos that is prevailing inside the country. Each region will select 20 deputies. Also sounds familiar. This undoes the General National Congress's original mandate while facilitating a drift towards federalism, or whatever that means. What we have now are bids, and in actuality, secessionism in the east of the country, as well as in the south of the country, and also in the west and central regions of the country. There are efforts to break away from any type of centralized authority inside of Libya. It also expands, this article continues, the influence of the president while inflaming social tensions. Now, many Libyans are now ready to join their brothers in Tunisia and Egypt by declaring their new regime a failure. Now, the second anniversary of the anti-Gaddafi uprisings, which in fact was a counter-revolution led, financed, coordinated, and directed by the United States and NATO, the so-called Libyan government today is bracing for huge demonstrations and attacks on government buildings, especially in Benghazi. And yesterday, there were thousands of people in the streets in Benghazi denouncing the rebel government in Tripoli. To help Zidane bring stability, win back the trust of his people, if he ever had it, and cement his legitimate authority against Maghreb's overreach, a new international coalition must help the Libyan government construct a coherent security apparatus. So this is what the authors of this article are saying. In fact, this is just calling for another imperialist intervention. They're admitting that what they carried out has brought chaos to the country, that it has not stabilized Libya, and they're using this as a rationale for reinviting the imperialists back into the country. In fact, they have never left. Now, just this last past Tuesday, representatives of the major Arab and Western powers, including the United States, met in Paris, France, under the aegis of the, quote, Support Libya Conference, unquote, and they agreed to, quote, the rapid deployment of European experts, unquote, to train and rebuild Libyan security forces. Well, rebuild what? I mean, they destroyed the Libyan army. The rebel militias have never been a disciplined force, so what are they rebuilding? And why do the Europeans have to come in and train Libyans to manage their own country? This, of course, is nothing but another excuse to bring a permanent military occupation of that oil-rich North African state. Now, to be effective, according to these authors, the whole process must be initiated, owned, and managed by the Libyans, while building upon the international community's role as guarantors of the Libyan revolution. In fact, guarantors of the Libyan counter-revolution is more accurate. Now, when Gaddafi's forces were poised to take back Benghazi in March of 2011 and crush the rebel movement in its infancy, the international community, meaning the imperialist countries, acted in an unprecedented manner. Well, there was nothing unprecedented about what happened in Libya. They had done the same thing in Iraq in 2003. They had done the same thing in Afghanistan in 2001. They've done the same thing in Somalia from 1992 all the way up to the present, passing a UN resolution calling for a no-fly zone and innovating ad hoc forms of cooperation to enforce it. The multilateral cooperation was led by France, Qatar, and the UK, with America playing a key supportive role. That is, of course, incorrect as well. The U.S. founded the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The Secretary General of NATO admitted after the seven-month bombing campaign of Libya that resulted in the overthrow of the government and the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi that the operation would have been totally impossible if it had not been for the coordination of the United States Pentagon. This is what the Secretary General of NATO admitted in November of 2011. So they're still perpetuating this same myth that the United States only played a supportive role in the overthrow of the Libyan government. However, this article continues, as soon as Gaddafi was defeated, the coalition melted away and subsequent international engagement has been sporadic and bilateral. Since multilateral engagement won the war, it is now time to reconstitute the coalition to win the peace. Now, here they go again, calling for Western imperialist intervention in Libya to even a greater degree. Tuesday's decision could be the turning point, just according to these authors. Success is achievable only if the right type of training is paired with high-level political engagement and if America invests significant diplomatic and technical resources. Well, this is a contradiction. They just said a couple of paragraphs above that the U.S. only played a supportive role in the overthrow of the Libyan government. Now they're saying, once again, as the Secretary General of NATO said in late 2011, that the engagement of America is essential in this whole process. The article goes on to say the coalition should start by training a new security force, approximately 6,000 strong. NATO countries should lead. Of course, NATO, in essence, is led by the United States Pentagon. But key Arab allies, meaning the Western-backed Arab regimes of Qatar and the others, should also be given a prominent role. You know, a prominent role meaning that they should be the foot soldiers for this U.S.-led effort. This force should receive what they call on-the-job training while securing the country's border and physical institutions. So what we're talking about is a takeover of the national institutions of the country and a takeover of the country's borders. American know-how, this article says, is needed to build an army capable of handling diverse threats from non-state actors, leaving the Europeans to focus on training the police. So they're saying once again that the Americans should be in charge. And when they say know-how, that is also questionable. This know-how was also utilized in the West African state of Mali in training the Malian army to supposedly be in a position to enhance its national security capability. And what happened there, the officer who was trained by the Pentagon here in the United States staged a coup against the democratically elected government. And the so-called training provided by AFRICOM has essentially crippled and made dysfunctional the Malian army. They are totally incapacitated as a result of dealing in regard to dealing with their own national security needs. And we'll talk about Mali a little bit later in the program. Now, the United Kingdom Prime Minister David Cameron made a savvy surprise visit to Tripoli on January 31st. Of course, Britain was heavily involved in the bombing of Libya as well. Secretary of State John Kerry should follow suit and go to Libya as part of his first trip to the Middle East. So they're already telling the U.S. State Department what to do, that they should actually take the lead in this new imperialist or renewed imperialist intervention in Libya. This would signal to the world's America's commitment to engagement. It could also signal the U.S.'s commitment to spearheading the diplomatic coalition and lending its unique technical experience rather than continuing its role of passively, quote, leading from behind, unquote. Now, this is the myth that has been perpetuated over the last 2 years in regard to Obama's involvement in the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya. In fact, the New York Times reported in the spring of 2011 that the Obama administration had signed a secret order right at the time of the outbreak of the so-called rebellion in Benghazi, signed a secret order dispatching Central Intelligence Agency operatives to Libya. And, of course, they weren't there just observing. They were there coordinating this so-called revolution against the Gaddafi government. Now, this same article goes on to say that if America attempted to dominate capacity-building efforts in Libya, it would fail and be accused of protecting its economic interests. However, if we coordinate our efforts with the coalition to help overthrow Gaddafi, Ali Zidane and the Libyan people would welcome such efforts. Well, that remains to be seen. Today, there's tremendous discontent in Libya. Even though the discontent in Benghazi, it appears, is not necessarily from a progressive perspective, although we really don't know, because it's illegal for people to come out and say that they support the Jemadiyah. But obviously there's extreme discontent in Libya on the second anniversary of the counter-revolution. Now, the last paragraph in this article says, even the speedy French-led dispersal of Islamist forces in Mali cannot provide long-term gains if Libya remains an ungoverned space. Well, the fact of the matter is, France is getting deeper and deeper into Mali. There was a major battle in Gao just last week that resulted in the deaths of many, many people after the Islamist forces took control of the police headquarters in Gao, and France had to come in with helicopter gunships to destroy the police headquarters, killing many people. They have been engaging in extreme human rights violations against the Malian people. They've also been bombing the mountainous areas in the northeast of Mali. This is the French imperialists who, in fact, are being ferreted into the country by U.S. warplanes. This article goes on to say that unrest in neighboring Tunisia, long thought of as the success story of the so-called Arab Spring, threatens to undermine the very model of transition from dictatorship to constitutional democracy in line with Islamist cultural norms. Libya has the wealth, educated populace, and strategic location to succeed. Well, where did this wealth come from? Who educated the population in Libya when they had free education? They had grants for people who got married, who had children, automatically got thousands of dollars from the Jemahiriya government. Everyone owned a house. Everyone had land. Many of the people there had their own businesses to the extent that they had to hire 2 million foreign guest workers to come in and work in the oil industry and the construction industry and the health industry because most Libyans wanted to work for themselves. And where did all this come from? They don't mention that in the conclusion of this article. Then it goes on to say in conclusion that it is up to the Libyans and their allies to close ranks. Libya is truly the linchpin to any comprehensive strategy to bring stability to North Africa and the Sahel. Well, where did the instability come from? How can the same people who created the instability, in fact, stabilize not only Libya but the entire region of North and West Africa? Now, this article was written by Jason Pack, who is the president of what is called LibyaAnalysis.com, and he is the editor of a new book entitled The 2011 Libyan Uprising and the Struggle for the Post-Qaddafi Future, and also co-authored by Karim Mezran, who is a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Rafik Hariri Center for Middle East and a professor at the School of African and International Studies at John Hopkins University. And, of course, the Atlantic Council is nothing but a pseudo-research center that serves as an apologist for imperialist intervention around the world. They go around making speeches, presenting papers, providing a deformed logic for greater U.S. military intervention in the regions of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the Pan-African Journal segment of the Pan-African Newswire, and we're talking about the second anniversary of the beginning of the uprising, the counter-revolution against the Jemahiriya in Libya, headed by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, who was captured, tortured, and assassinated at the aegis of the United States and NATO on October the 20th of 2011. And there are a series of these articles that have been published on the Pan-African Newswire just to give you an indication of the twisted logic of the imperialists and their apologists. They're admitting that what they did in Libya in 2011 has been a total failure. They're admitting that chaos now prevails in Libya. They're admitting that the destabilization of the Gaddafi government that has resulted in the spread of war in Mali and in other regions throughout North and West Africa. They're admitting this, but they're admitting it in a way in which it calls for increased and renewed intervention by these same imperialist forces who destabilized Libya some 2 years ago. Now, in neighboring Egypt, the situation there is also very unstable. The recent death of activist Mohamed El Gindi has prompted the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights to call for investigations into alleged police torture. The Cairo-based Egyptian Organization for Human Rights has called for an immediate investigation into the death of Mohamed El Gindi, who was allegedly tortured to death by police following a series of protests last month. El Gindi, who was 28 years old, disappeared in late January, only to reappear at a hospital over a week later, having sustained injuries to which he eventually succumbed. Police were subsequently accused of torturing him to death at a Central Security camp after acquaintances of the slain man alleged that the activist had disappeared during clashes with security forces near Cairo's Tahrir Square. The Egyptian Organization for Human Rights cited witness testimony, which is already being investigated by the Egyptian Prosecutor General's office, suggesting El Gende had been tortured to death. Quote, when the Egyptian Ministry of Justice stated that El Gende had died in a car accident, eyewitness Sharif El Bahiri, a former Muslim Brotherhood member, stated that the victim had died under torture, unquote. Now, this is according to the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights. Justice and Interior Ministry officials stated earlier this week that El Gende had died from injuries sustained in an automobile accident. Lawyer Mohammed Abdel Aziz, who was present at El Bahiri's testimony, told Akram Online that he planned to call for investigations into Justice Minister Ahmed Miki for the latter's assertion that a coroner's report had attributed El Gende's death to a car accident. Quote, torturing people into giving confessions violates international standards of human rights, unquote, and that's according to the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights. They said, and we continue, quote, responsibility for this incident should be assumed not only by the security, Central Security Forces and the Egyptian Ministry of the Interior, but also by the Egyptian government and the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party, unquote. The organization went on to call on Egypt's Prosecutor General to launch an immediate investigation into cases of police torture. Quote, perpetrators must be held accountable, unquote, and that's according to the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And we're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. Now, in the southern African nation of Zimbabwe, the government is preparing for a national referendum on the new constitution that is scheduled to take place next month. President Robert Mugabe has reiterated his call for peace and a culture of nonviolence in Zimbabwe as the country prepares for a referendum and harmonized elections. The country will hold a referendum on a new constitution on March the 16th, and thereafter it will hold harmonized elections. Now, he said, quote, we do not want violence, Mugabe said. Why should you club your opponent? Why should we worry when we have a party that empowers people in their own country and respects Africans' dignity? If they don't support you, what can you do? There are people who behave like wild animals. The president said that this while officially opening the annual Chiefs Conference and launched 7 community share ownership trusts in Masvingo on February the 15th. He said, quote, let's unite and vote properly and correctly, but no to violence. We need to go out and vote so that we get rid of these three-headed creatures, unquote, the president said. He castigated chiefs and senior government officials fronting for whites, saying he had full details and would not hesitate to expose them. He urged Zimbabweans to stop placing their faith in the white man instead of seizing opportunities created by land reform and the indigenization and economic empowerment drive. The president warned Zimbabweans to be vigilant as white former farmers and diehard Rhodesians were sweating to reverse the gains of the land reform program. And he said, quote, we don't want to end up repossessing some of the farms that we gave you under the land reform program, but we know a lot of things that are happening on the farms. He said, quote, we know a lot of things that some of you do not even know, and it's not chiefs alone who are fronting for the white men. There are even some senior government officials who are being used by whites. Beware, unquote, the president said. The president said those who were leasing their farms to former white farmers would end up losing them to the same people as the whites were still keen to reclaim the land in Zimbabwe. He said, quote, I am not saying beware because I am having that spirit to seize those farms from those of you who are fronting for the white men, but the former white farmers and Rhodesians are coming back and may even take back the farms. They are coming back to take the resources before the Ivan Mugabe comes, unquote, said President Mugabe. The president challenged skills skilled and educated Zimbabweans who benefited from Zimbabwe's education system to start forming their own companies and exploit Zimbabwe's vast natural resources. He said, quote, our people were used to working for the white man. I appeal to our educated and skilled indigenous people to come together and start businesses. Our people should not develop cold feet that they would need big machines and colossal equipment to run their companies. They can hire those machines and even come to us as government, and we will assist them. He went on to say that the Rhodesians are coming back into the country and are the ones who have companies that manufacture these big equipment parts, like combine harvesters that we need on our farms. And if we are not careful, eventually they will take our farms again, the president said. He said Zimbabwe welcomed foreign investors, but only those with a friendly disposition and willing to subscribe to the terms set by the people of Zimbabwe. He said the land reform program was the first of a series of stages that the government embarked on to gradually transfer control of the means of production from the white minority to the majority of Zimbabweans. Zimbabweans, said President Mugabe, were now supposed to assume total control of all their natural resources. He said, quote, when we first took our land from the whites, we knew that we were on the first stage of transferring wealth from whites to blacks. And he went on to say, we knew exactly what we were on the first stage of taking our resources after we had educated our people from 1980 when we started building schools in all parts of the country. We now have many educated people, and we should now move to assume total control of our natural resources. Mugabe said, quote, we can now stand on our own. President Mugabe hailed chiefs for being custodians of Zimbabwe's tradition and culture. He said, while it was important for black people to adopt some foreign cultural practices that were progressive, alien practices should never have a place in Zimbabwe's culture. President Mugabe said the same people who brought heinous practices to blacks, colonized and oppressed them under the pretext of bringing civilization should be rejected. He, however, urged chiefs to campaign for a yes vote, saying the party that wins the next elections could choose to amend a new constitution. President Mugabe said the draft constitution was a compromise document. He said Zimbabweans should focus on the referendum paving the way for the elections. He warned Zimbabweans against falling prey to some unscrupulous money lending and investment firms sprouting all over the country. Seven companies named Bakita Minerals, Lennox Mine, Renko Mine, Steelmakers, Gaff Mines, Tongat Ulit, and Save Valley Conservancy will pour $1 million U.S. dollars each for various trusts. Mugabe also officially handed over a check of $1 million from Maroa Diamond Mine for the Chavie Community Shares Ownership Scheme and $500,000 from the Bakita Minerals for the Share Ownership Scheme for Bakita. And finally, the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice, based here in the city of Detroit, has issued a call for a conference to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Organization of African Unity, the forerunner of the African Union. May 25th, the call says, will mark the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Organization of African Unity in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, the continental organization formed by all of the heads of state to accelerate the liberation from colonialism and the political, economic, and social unification of Africa. The OAU was formed by 33 independent states, including some of the leading figures in the Pan-African struggle, such as Presidents Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, Ahmed Sekou Touré, Modibo Keita, Julius Nyerere, Gamal Abdel Nasser, His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie, among others. The call continues, saying that after five decades of the OAU and its successor, the African Union, formed in 2002, it is necessary for a thorough assessment of the progress and challenges facing Africa and the diaspora in light of the escalating imperialist militarism being carried out by the United States, France, Britain, and other NATO countries. Today, in 2013, African states are being invaded once again by troops from the Pentagon, various NATO forces, Central Intelligence Agency operatives, and other intelligence organizations from throughout North America and Europe, as well as transnational corporations and banks determined to maintain Western hegemony over the continent and its peoples and resources. Now, 5 years ago, in 2008, the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice held a similar conference in the wake of the formation of the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM. In 2008, we predicted that the formation of this Pentagon command, specifically geared toward Africa, would prove disastrous for the continent. Unfortunately, what we anticipated has been proven correct. AFRICOM coordinated the overthrow of the government in Libya under the martyred Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, a longtime leader of his country, who served as a co-founder of the African Union and its chairman in 2009 and 2010. Although the headquarters of AFRICOM remains in Stuttgart, Germany, the U.S. has established a military base in Djibouti, along with drone and CIA stations in Somalia, Niger, and other countries across the continent. The current war in Mali, although said to be waged by France for humanitarian reasons, is merely designed to penetrate the continent and exploit its oil, uranium, and gold. Africa is playing a greater role in supplying oil, platinum, natural gas, and other strategic resources to the Western industrialized capitalist states. Therefore, we believe that a renewed anti-imperialist campaign aimed at enhancing solidarity with Africa and its people is necessary during this period. This conference will take up some of the most important aspects of the struggle for the total liberation and unification of the continent and the diaspora. Now, some of the issues that will be thoroughly discussed at the Africa and U.S. Imperialism Conference will include a historical review of the OAU and the African Union from 1963 to 2013, the role of AFRICOM, the CIA, NATO, and other intelligence and military groups, the Africa Decade of Women from 2010 to 2020, and the need for full gender equality and empowerment, youth and development in Africa and the diaspora, the impact of the global economic crisis on Africa and the diaspora, Africa and the global class struggle against imperialism, Africa in solidarity with Latin America, the Middle East, Asia, and all struggling peoples, and China's role in Africa and its implications for the worldwide struggle against imperialism. Now, this conference will seek the support and participation of all genuine anti-imperialists, left, pan-African, social justice, women, anti-war, peace, and environmental, and community and social justice organizations. The conference will be self-financed and organized. The conclusion of this call says that if you or your organization is interested in contributing to this call, please contact us as soon as possible. The conference will draft a program of action and publish many of the papers and talks presented during the proceedings. And for people who want more information on this conference, they merely have to continue to follow the Pan-African Newswire and the Pan-African Journal, and in doing that, you'll be able to get more information on this upcoming conference that will be taking place possibly in May of this year. And but the details will be coming forward. And that will conclude this week's edition of the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding the Pan-African Newswire for this week, we'd like to recap the major stories in the Pan-African Newswire for this week. The second anniversary of the counter-revolution in the North African state of Libya has been marked by demonstrations and heightened security inside the country. Several articles by apologists for imperialism have admitted that the U.S. NATO-led war that overthrew the Jemahiriya has been a disaster for the country and its people. These failures are now being utilized as a new rationale for deeper imperialist intervention in Libya and throughout the entire region of North Africa. Egyptian organizations have called for an investigation into the death of an activist, Mohamed El-Gindi. Meanwhile, demonstrations have continued across the country against the Freedom and Justice Party government of Mohamed Morsi. In the southern African state of Zimbabwe, the country is preparing for a national referendum on a new constitution. The vote, which is scheduled to take place on March 16th, is a precursor for political elections later in the year. And finally, the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice has issued a call for a conference on Africa and U.S. imperialism. The conference is being held in commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Organization of African Unity in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, on May 25th of 2013. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's edition of the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. If you're interested in reading the Pan-African Newswire on a daily basis, all you have to do is log on to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And right now we're going to take a brief musical break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And, of course, we heard two tracks from South African reggae artist Lucky Dube, Respect, and before that, Prisoner. And just this last past week, there was much discussion in regard to this new renewed campaign for gun control laws inside the United States. In the state of Connecticut, there was a demonstration yesterday dealing, in fact, on Thursday, dealing with this issue. Prior to that, there was discussion about the almost epidemic level of violence in the city of Chicago, resulting from gang violence and other interpersonal conflicts. And yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, was called upon by Press TV, their world news desk, to comment on the demonstrations in Connecticut and also about this renewed effort in regard to the passage of gun control laws here in the United States. We're going to play that interview right now. Are you listening to the Pan-African Journal? And I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe.
Meanwhile, U.S. protesters have pushed for tougher gun control laws in the country. Thousands have rallied in the state of Connecticut to make their voices heard. Demonstrators gathered outside the state capitol calling on lawmakers to take action to reduce gun-related violence. The mass rally was organized by a group called March for Change. Organizers said they're mainly motivated by the recent school shooting in Connecticut, which left 26 people dead, most of them children. Gun violence has become a heated debate in the U.S. following a string of high-profile deadly shootings. Every day, over 80 people die of gunshot wounds across America. Well, to discuss that a bit further, we're now joined by Mr. Abayomi Azikiwe, who is with the Pan-African Newswire, who's joining us now on the line from Detroit. Mr. Azikiwe, thanks a lot for joining us. Now, you know, protesters are pushing for tougher gun laws in Connecticut. Do you believe that they will be successful, essentially, at this point?
Well, they may be successful, but I do not believe that tougher gun laws in any state inside the United States is going to solve the fundamental problem of violence inside the country. It's a systemic problem. It comes from the government, from the military, all the way down to the state, local, and rural areas. There is a culture of impunity. There's a culture of gun violence here inside the United States. And until that is addressed on a systematic basis, it will not improve the overall security situation inside the United States. It's very interesting that in the urban areas where you have high homicide rates, high rates of personal violence, interpersonal violence and crime, that has not been the trigger for these gun laws. It's only when these shootings have taken place in areas that are more affluent among the dominant majority population do we see this type of national outcry for more gun laws. But no, I do not believe that the imposition of tougher gun laws is going to solve the problem of interpersonal violence inside the United States.
So, Mr. Azikiwe, you know, you speak about a systematic approach to solving this issue, this gun culture that you speak about. Then what, then, is the first step that needs to be taken on the part of the government to start to address this issue?
Well, they need to, first of all, end the wars of aggression and occupation that are going on in Afghanistan, the problems associated with the drone attacks in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia. They need to halt the threats that are being made against the Islamic Republic of Iran, against the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And there needs to be a more systematic approach to how law enforcement is carried out inside the United States. Disarming citizens in the United States, when at the same time you have the police and the federal officials being heavily armed, is not a solution to the problem. The only solution to this problem is to address the systematic inequality, the militarism that is, in fact, implemented on a high level inside the United States, from the White House, from the Pentagon on down. This is the only way that there can be an honest approach to the elimination or the reduction of interpersonal violence inside the United States.
All right, we'll have to leave there for now. That was Abayomi Azikiwe with the Pan-African Newswire, speaking to us on the line from Detroit. Sir, as always, we appreciate your insights.
And that was an interview that took place just this last past Thursday with yours truly, Abayomi Azikiwe, the host of the Pan-African Journal and editor of the Pan-African Newswire, over Press TV World News, discussing the concept of gun control and gun violence here in the United States. Now, during that interview, we mentioned the fact that the U.S. military is heavily responsible for promoting the gun culture and the culture of violence within the territorial boundaries of the United States itself. And just on Monday, there was on Sunday, excuse me, there was a interview as well, a statement that was delivered to Press TV U.S. desk by yours truly, Abayomi Azikiwe, dealing with the character and the size of the Pentagon budget here in the United States. We're going to play that statement for you right now. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and right now we're going to listen to a statement delivered to Press TV's U.S. desk just this last past Sunday.
To the ongoing unnecessary high military budget in the United States, it's important to note that the budget for military affairs in the United States far exceeds any other country around the world. In fact, it exceeds all of the countries combined in regard to the level of military expenditures. Just recently, the United States Congress approved a military budget of some $633 billion. This does not include the supplemental budget additions in relationship to the war in Afghanistan, as well as other military operations that are being carried out now by the United States. If you combine the military budget of the United States with the national security budget, as represented by Homeland Security, it exceeds $1 trillion. This, of course, is unsustainable, particularly in light of the fact that the United States now is facing what they describe as a fiscal cliff. Public education, public services, such as lighting and public transportation are being cut. Austerity is being imposed by the various states around the U.S. on municipalities and suburbs and small towns. These funds that are utilized for the carrying on of war and other military expenditures should be utilized to rebuild the states, the cities, the suburbs, and the small towns, as well as the rural areas throughout the United States. This is necessary in order for any semblance of economic revival to take place inside the United States.
And that was a statement delivered to Press TV's U.S. desk dealing with the character of the military budget here in the United States, a budget that exceeds all other military budgets around the world combined. And, of course, you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And during our Pan-African Newswire reports, we talked about the upcoming national elections in the Southern African state of Zimbabwe. The vote on the new draft constitution will be taking place on March the 16th. And sometimes after that, there will be national harmonized elections for the presidency as well as the national parliament. And Zimbabwe today is still under extreme sanctions by the U.S., Britain, the European Union, and other allied countries around the world. This is due in large part to the massive land reform program that was embarked upon by the government in 2000. The corporate media around the world has vilified the Zimbabwean government now for the last 15 years. And in order to counter that, to provide a more objective outlook on the situation in Zimbabwe, a documentary filmmaker has just completed a new product that gives a more balanced and objective view on the situation in Zimbabwe. That film, entitled Mugabe, Villain or Hero, was screened just this last past week at the Pan-African Film Festival in Los Angeles. And right now, we'd like to play the trailer from that film. And it is a film that hopefully we'll be able to get a hold of in the not-too-distant future.
Car accident. Zimbabwe is for Zimbabweans. It cannot be for the Americans. It cannot be for the British.
It is very unfortunate how they disengaged. So I'm talking now about the new Labour government declared that they are a new party without a colonial past to answer for. Now, even as white Zimbabweans, we were horrified at that.
Taking me this crook called Blair, saying, no, we are not going to pay you anything.
When we reclaimed our land from these white people, Britain, America, and the EU, were not amused.
Because they knew they were wrong. They thought of how they can punish this man, dictator, Kolingani.
Terrorism is about the destruction of life. Sanctions, in our case, is caused the destruction of life.
And this sanction must be removed. You are killing people. You are not killing Robert Mugabe.
The selling media, yes, they're printing more papers in England, whatever cases, because they're publishing all the bullshit about what's going on in Zimbabwe, but they're not telling the truth. They're not showing us the true story of what's happening in our country.
But maybe then they should come into the country and then they can tell the truth.
Here we have a president, a man of principles, a man who has stood up against all and all and said, Zimbabwe to the Zimbabweans.
Finally, after 2 years, we got the call to interview the president.
Success. Nehru and N.
We gon' fight, we gonna fight. real revolutionary. And I don't want my people to be tricked by mercenaries. Brother, you're right, you're right, you're right.
Zimbabwe, yes, and that is also a tribute to Bob Marley himself, who we just commemorated his birthday on February the 6th, the 58th birthday of Bob Marley, who was born in 1945, and Bob Marley, of course, 68th birthday of Bob Marley, who was born in 1945. Bob Marley, of course, he made his transition in 1981. Yes, Bob Marley with the sound of Zimbabwe. And prior to that, we heard a trailer of the new film, Mugabe, Hero or Villain, done by Ghanaian a filmmaker, Roy Ayamang. And, of course, as we said earlier, we're going to try to get that film and bring it to the city of Detroit. And right now, as part of our African American History Month series, we're going to, of course, pay tribute to the late, great Malcolm X, who this coming February 21st will represent the 48th anniversary of his martyrdom, which took place on February 21st of 1965, and this is a speech delivered by Malcolm X in Los Angeles, California, on May 5th of 1962. It was a speech that was delivered in the immediate aftermath of the attack by the Los Angeles police on the headquarters of the Nation of Islam in that city, resulting in the death of Muslim Ronald Stokes.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, to whom all praise is due, whom we forever thank for giving us the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as our leader, teacher, and guide. And I specifically, ladies and gentlemen, and brothers and sisters, open up like that because I am a representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And were it not for him, you and I wouldn't be here today. In order for you and me to devise some kind of method or strategy to offset some of the events or repetition of the events that have taken place here in Los Angeles recently, we have to go to the root. We have to go to the cause. Dealing with the condition itself is not enough. We have to get to the cause of it all, or the root of it all. And it is because of our effort toward getting straight to the root that people oftentimes think we are dealing in hate. But first, I would like to congratulate and give praise to the Negro, so-called Negro leaders and so-called Negro organizations. And excuse me if I say so-called, it's hard for me to just outright say Negro when I know what that word Negro really means. The person whom you have come to know as Ronald Stokes, we know him as Brother Ronald. One of the most religious persons who displayed the highest form of morals of any black person anywhere on this earth. And as one of the previous speakers pointed out who knew him, everyone who knew him had to give him credit for being a good man, a clean man, an intelligent man, and an innocent man when he was murdered. The Negro, so-called Negro organizations and leaders should be given great credit for their failure or refusal to let the white man divide them and use them one against the other during this crisis. As Reverend Wilfred Wilson pointed out, I think it was 8 years ago today that the Supreme Court handed down the desegregation decision. And despite the fact that 8 years have gone past, that decision hasn't been implemented yet. I don't have that much faith. I don't have that much confidence. I don't have that much patience. And I don't have that much ignorance if the Supreme Court, which is the highest law-making body in the country, can pass a decision that can't get even 8% compliance within 8 years because it's for black people, then my patience has run out. When black people who are being oppressed become impatient, they say that's emotional. Please, when black people who are being deprived of their citizenship, not only of their civil rights, but their human rights, become impatient, become fed up, don't want to wait any longer, then they say that's emotional. The Negro, so-called Negro leaders and organizations should be praised. They should be congratulated. They should be complimented, because out of all of them combined, the white man has not yet found one who will play the role of Uncle Tom. But yet he has found no Tom, no puppet, no parrot who is still dumb enough in 1962 to represent the injustices that he's inflicting against our people. We don't care what your religion is. We don't care what organization you belong to. We don't care how far in school you went or didn't go. We don't care what kind of job you have. We have to give you credit for shocking the white man by not letting him divide you and use you one against the other. In the past, the greatest weapon the white man has had has been his ability to divide and conquer. As Jackie Robinson pointed out beautifully on the television last night, 4/5 of the world isn't white. Isn't that what Jackie said? And if 4/5 of the world is dark, how is it possible for 1/5 to rule, oppress, exploit, dominate, and brutalize the 4/5 who are in the majority?
How do they do it?
Divide and conquer. If I take my hand and slap you, you don't even feel it. It might sting you because these digits are separated. But all I have to do to put you back in your place is bring those digits together. This is what the white man has done to you and me. He has divided us and used us one against the other. But today, thanks to Allah, you can say thanks to God or thanks to Jesus or thanks to Jehovah, whatever you want. But as a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, we have been taught to say thanks to Allah. And that's what Jesus said. Jesus called on Allah. He said, Allah, Allah, lama sabachthani. I believe what's good for Jesus is good for you. If Allah was good enough for Jesus to call upon, I think he should be good enough for you to call upon. Since the so-called Negro community has shot the white man by resisting all efforts to divide us, I think that you and I should continue to shock him by seeing and working together in unity. Despite religious, political, economic, or educational, or social differences, let us remember that we're not brutalized because we're Baptist. We're not brutalized because we're Methodist. We're not brutalized because we're Muslim. We're not brutalized because we're Catholic. We're brutalized because we are black people in America. Where your mother is being raped and you're not supposed to be emotional. Your women, please, your women can't walk the street without some cracker putting his hands on her, and you're not supposed to be emotional. If you say that you're fed up, if you teach the Negro, people don't even know their own name. Why? Because he took it away from them. Please, please. 20 million black people don't even know their own language. Why? Because he took it away from them. 20 million black people who don't even know the history of their ancestors. Why? Because he took it away from them. And if you're trying to tell them how thoroughly and completely they've been robbed, he says you're teaching hate. That's something to think about. Today, you're coming out of college. You're coming out of the leading university. You're trying to go in a good direction, but you don't know which direction to go in. And if somebody tries to take you right to the root of your problem, they say that that man's a hate teacher. If I ask why should the senators in Washington, and then again, if we tell you that Negroes are being hung on the tree or being shot down illegally, unjustly, and those Negroes should do something to protect themselves, you say you're advocating violence. The white man is tricking you. He's trapping you. He doesn't call it violence when he lands troops in South Vietnam. And please, please, please. He doesn't call it violence when he lands troops in Berlin. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, he didn't say get nonviolent. He said, praise the Lord, but pass the ammunition. But when someone attacks you, when someone comes at you with a club, when someone comes at you with a rope, when someone comes at you with a gun, despite the fact that you've done nothing, he tells you, suffer peacefully. Pray for those who use you despitefully. Be long-suffering. And how long can you suffer after suffering for 400 years? So I just want to clear up that little point right there, because he says that we play on your emotions. And when you turn on your television tonight or your radio, or read the newspaper, they're going to tell you in that paper that I was playing on your emotions. Imagine you, a second-class citizen. That's not getting emotional, it's getting intelligent. And as far as your mayor is concerned, I see shit say their mayor. A man named Yorty, who has been slandering the Muslims, A professional liar. A professional liar. Who has mastered the art of using half-truth. Put it in the paper that they broke into our religious place of worship and got records that they can use to prove that most of us have criminal records. You can't be a Negro in America and not have a criminal record. Martin Luther King has been to jail. Please. James Farmer has been to jail. Why, you can't name a black man in this country who is sick and tired of the hell that he's catching who hasn't been to jail. Charged him with being seditious. They put Moses in jail. They put Daniel in jail. Why, you haven't got a man of God in the Bible that wasn't put to jail when they started speaking out against exploitation and oppression. Jesus with sedition. Didn't they do that? They said he was against Caesar. They said he was discriminating because he told his disciples, go not the way of the Gentiles, but rather go to the lost sheep. He discriminated. Don't go near the Gentiles, go to the lost sheep. Go to the oppressed. Go to the downtrodden. Go to the exploited. Go to the people who don't know who they are, who are lost from the knowledge of themselves, and who are strangers in a land that is not theirs. Go to those people. Go to the slaves. Go to the second-class citizens. Go to the ones who are suffering the brunt of Caesar's brutality. And if Jesus were here in America today, he wouldn't be going to the white man. The white man is the oppressor. He would be going to the oppressed. He would be going to the humble. He would be going to the lowly. He would be going to the rejected and the despised. He would be going to the so-called American Negro. To have once been a criminal with no disgrace. To remain a criminal is the disgrace. I formerly was a criminal. I formerly was in prison. I'm not ashamed of that. You never can use that over my head. And that he's using the wrong stick. I don't feel that stick. I went to prison because I believed in men like Sam Yorty. I went to prison because I trusted men like Sam Yorty. I went to prison following the philosophy of men like Sam Yorty. But since I've been following the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I have been reformed, and that's more, please. That's more than Sam Yorty and Chief Parker and all these other white politicians have been able to do with the inmates in the prison of this state. They should give Mr. Muhammad credit. They should give Mr. Muhammad credit for reforming and rehabilitating men whom they have failed to reform and rehabilitate.
And welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. We're closing out our program this week with a tribute to Malcolm X, and we'll continue that tribute next week. Coming up on the anniversary of the martyrdom of Malcolm X, 48 years ago on February 21st, 1965, Malcolm X was gunned down in New York City. And we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Journal is brought to you by the Pan-African Radio Network. And we want to encourage you to inform others about the existence of this program. And also to log on to the Pan-African Newswire at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. This is Abayomi Azikwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Africa, unite.
Gaza children wanna come home. Africa, unite. Cause we're moving right out of Babylon. And we're grooving to our fatherland. Yeah. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man to see the unification of all Rastaman. Yeah. Has it been said already?